Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The race is on, and with Ferrari becoming the first team to hit the track in 2021, albeit running a 2018 car, we're taking a close look at Charles Leclerc. Is he the real deal? How good is he? And does he make too many mistakes? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me with all the answers are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Scott, hello. Have you got round to planning what you're going to do with the extra 10 minutes you've gained this year on Grand Prix weekends?
Yeah, I'm gonna spend it. I'm probably gonna travel. Actually, you know, use that extra time I get to, you know, see the world, small place. So, you know, every bit adds up. No, I think it'll be useful. Bit of extra prep time in the evening. Make sure the podcasts are better than ever. You know, punchier, filled with better answers, more concise. For example, for this podcast here, I'll wrap the podcast up in a few seconds, shall I? Yes, Charles Leclerc's the real deal. How good is he? Very good. Does he make too many mistakes? Yes, at the moment, but I'm sure he'll get better.
Yeah, well, that's very good. You've jumped ahead.
Join us again next week for another episode of the Race F1 podcast.
You're one of those people who jumps to the end of the book to see how it ends, aren't you, before you decide to continue?
No, but I do occasionally accidentally read the end of the page before I finish the bit that I'm on. My eyes wander. That's all.
Yeah, fair enough. We have, of course, got a little bit more meat to put on that bone. But I'd also like to know, Mark Hughes, what you're going to do with that extra 10 minutes from the race starting 10 minutes early. I plan to watch an extra 10 minutes of driver on board footage from the race to try and glean what's been going on. That's my plan for it.
I'm just going to save it. I'm just going to save them. So, you know, if we're lucky enough to get 20 races, that's 200 minutes. I don't know. I can do something with them at the end of the season.
That's a very, very good idea. I like that, planning ahead. Give yourself an early night in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. And I've got a different answer to Scott for question three. So that's good. So that means we've got something to talk about. Questions one and two are the same. Question three, no, my answer's different.
So that's okay. We've got a nice narrative structure there. We've got a little bit of conflict. So there's going to be some disagreements. There's potential for all of us to go through a good journey as characters. And it'll start off nicely, and then we'll throw in a little bit of peril. So I like this. This is a good narrative structure. But we're gonna dispense with that immediately and go slightly off-piste just before we delve into Charles Leclerc, because we should talk about his new teammate, Carlos Sainz. He had his first test in an F1 Ferrari at Fiorano last week. One of half a dozen drivers in action, with Leclerc himself also getting a bit of mileage to sharpen up ahead of pre-season testing. Mick Schumacher, Robert Schwartzman, Marcus Armstrong, and outgoing Academy driver Giuliano Alesi also had runs. But Sainz is the one we're interested in. So what did you glean from his day and a half of running, Scott?
Mainly an indication of how Carlos is going to be attacking, or is already attacking, this Ferrari opportunity. Because obviously there's so limited, if anything, to be gained from the 2018 car itself from a performance point of view. Like, it predates the aero change in 2019. So I'll be amazed if he learned anything about actually how Ferrari cars work in terms of performance. But in terms of processes, systems, personnel, that would have been really useful, because he's been in Maranello. I understand he's been a model student at Maranello through January so far. Plenty of time on the simulator. He's been doing his homework. But actually operating the steering wheel, operating in a Ferrari environment, communicating with his new engineers in a racing situation, or at least an on-track situation, which is what he would have been able to practice at Fiorano. That is different to doing it in a controlled environment, whether that's in the factory, just talking to one another, or especially on the simulator. So I think that Carlos has gained quite a lot from this day and a half. He says that there's quite a lot of detail that he's picked up that's going to be beneficial. It's all about fast-tracking the learning process. There's only 3 days of preseason testing this year in the 2021 cars, which means a day and a half for Carlos. And it's just very similar to what we've heard from Fernando Alonso driving the 2018 Renault last year. And then obviously Fernando got to drive the 2020 car. We won't revisit that little controversy here in Abu Dhabi. But basically, it's that level of fine margins and marginal gains that Sainz is pursuing. And if you're chasing the same kind of thing as Fernando Alonso, then your processes can't be far wrong, can they?
I also noticed, Mark, I think you retweeted or commented on a social media post that Carlos had been going out of his way to be friendly to a few gathered Ferrari fans. Yeah.
There was a lovely little tweet on there that some fan had been down at Fiorano, said there were about seven of us clinging onto the fence all day, just watching them go round and round. And at the end of the day, you know, they were packing up, and there was a little small fire truck came along the track, and they were wondering what was happening, and then it stopped just in front of them, and out stepped Carlos and come to have a chat with them, and they'd been there all day. So it was just a nice little just the way Carlos is. He's a lovely guy, and he's very warm, and he's gonna go down an absolute storm with the Tifosi. And so I don't think that was just him ingratiating himself. I think it is just his natural way. He'll have seen them. He's thinking they're still there after all this time. I can just going to say thank you afterwards, really. It's just nice.
I assume that was the same group of fans that he'd, the same small group of fans that he'd noticed at the very start of the day, because he said that on his, basically right at the very beginning, he noticed there were a couple of banners being held trackside. One that said, I think one said Vamos Carlos, and the other one had Smooth Operator on it, which obviously is a reference to his radio sing-along joke at McLaren. As Mark said, didn't go unnoticed from Carlos. It's just, I think a lot of the drivers would notice that sort of thing trackside. I think precious few would do what he did and actually go over and have a go. So he's properly emotionally invested in Ferrari. He had his dad there at the test as well, Carlos Sr., which shows that just because he's in this new environment and he's stepping up and he's a bigger and better driver than ever, Junior's not going to separate himself from the support group that he had before. So yeah, it was really interesting, actually. As far as a day and a half test in an old car goes, I think we learned actually quite a lot about Carlos. Not necessarily sort of much that's strikingly new, but more of a reinforcement of the values and qualities that make him a very good driver, and as Mark said, just a decent person as well.
I hope Carlos Sr. was able to give him a few tips from his Formula Ford racing days. I'm sure that's what he was there for, to offer some insight.
I talked to Carlos Sr. about his Formula Ford festival, and he said it was also new to him because he'd been rallying, but he'd got a budget to go and do the Formula Ford festival. And it was also new to him that he couldn't understand why the brake lights, because it was a wet session, so people had their lights on. And he said he came back in. He thought that the brake lights were, people had wired them up to keep them on all the time, just to, so that he couldn't work out where they were braking. And somebody pointed out to him that they weren't brake lights. That's how Roy Senior was at that point.
We're obviously going massively off piece. But I heard a brilliant Junior and Senior story the other day, which is from when I think when Carlos would Junior would have been about maybe 15, and he went to a like an ice driving, like snow driving course at somewhere in Scandinavia, so they were driving. I think it was the day was with Porsche, so they were driving quite nice cars out on the snow and ice, and had this little course made up, and they both took part. But then Senior, you know, went inside, was enjoying warming up, some coffee, whatever. Junior just kept pounding round, and eventually got to the point where he was matching, or very close to matching, Senior's times. And then Senior noticed, and at this point they were still very, very much competitive. So Senior was having none of it and told them to run the track the other way around. So then they had to set their times again, and apparently Junior got nowhere near him. I think it was Carlos's karting experience meant that, you know, learning a track was, he was able to get sort of quite close to his dad. And then actually when it came to, no, start again, because Senior was apparently like, this is what rallying's really like.
Like to see a bit of intergenerational competition. That's a good story. Just finally on science, I do like it. Whenever we have these drivers moving in to teams and it's all sweetness and light and positivity, isn't it? It's always quite funny. I'm not saying it's going to end this way because I think science at Ferrari will go well. But it is interesting, isn't it, that when drivers first go in, everyone's very excited. It's a great new exciting relationship. And then you sort of think back to the past of how certain partnerships ended. And, you know, some end very amicably. No reason why this one won't. But there's always going to be a few that start brilliantly and then go downhill. But at this sort of stage, it's all looking very good. But anyway, that's just a thought that struck me. Let's get on to the main topic today. Get back onto the narrative course. Charles Leclerc. The main reason for this is that in our discussion about the top 10 drivers last year, it was Leclerc in third place who seemed to get the most pushback from people, based on the comments we got. So we're going to break down his game into its component parts to try and get a deeper understanding of his strengths and weaknesses. So let's start out, Mark, with what is the bedrock of any Grand Prix driver's game, which is how quick is Leclerc? We're talking here about the underlying pace. So in particular, qualifying pace, that raw speed.
He's stunningly fast. He might be the fastest driver on the grid. It might be Lewis Hamilton, might be Max Verstappen. I don't think you could definitely say one of those is quicker than the other two. It would just depend upon the day and the circumstances, but he's one of the three guys I would say that is capable of being the absolute outright quickest over a lap. And some of his performances last year in a less than great car were mind-blowing in qualifying. I'm thinking of probably the best example was Portimao, but Mugello, Silverstone. Several times as a car that on merit was probably up a Q2, he stuck on the second or third row of the grid. And he not only got through Q2 when he shouldn't have done, he once even managed, I think it was Portimao, he managed to do it on the medium tyre, which was a risk that even Red Bull didn't think was worth taking because it was too marginal. He not only managed to get through Q2 in a car that couldn't do it, he did it on the slower tyre and therefore give himself half a chance of having a good race. And went on to finish fourth in that race. I don't think there's any question that he's of his raw one-lap pace. It's just amazing. And he's a very attacking sort of driver, and this goes out into a wider point as his whole quality, not just his speed. But when you're in compromised competitive circumstances and you've got a car that's not a stellar car, and you can throw caution to the wind if you're good enough to be able to pull something out of the bag that transcends its notional level, if you like. But there comes with that a concomitant risk that, you know, it can go wrong. So I don't think when somebody that pulls off things like he did last year gets a car that poor, that high up the grid, I don't think you can then criticize the errors, because that's just part and parcel of getting a mediocre car into positions it doesn't deserve. For every three times you'll do that, you'll put it in the wall another time. But you can't count that as a mistake. That would be a mistake if you were in a pole position contending car and every fourth time you made an error. But that's not the same thing. That's a completely, you're trying to do a completely different task to than you are in trying to put a competitive car on pole position. You're just trying to transcend that car by as much as you possibly can, and then just on the off chance to get a result that it doesn't deserve. And I think this is what we saw last year. Prior to that, the seasons prior to that, like the qualifying shunt in Baku in 2019, things like that were more, I think you could put more down to inexperience and just building up the data banks. But the sort of things we saw last year, we're just trying to put a car that didn't deserve to be where it was and try to keep it there. So I think if we see a good Ferrari this year or a half decent Ferrari this year, I don't think you'll see the same thing. And I think in terms of his speed, another little indication of his speed, in his rookie year at Baku, 2018 in the Sauber, there was a point in that race where he was snapping at the heels of Raikkonen's Ferrari and lapping about a second and a half faster than his teammate. And that car, several times in the second half of that year in particular, was fighting out best of the rest for Class B. He was fighting with Renaults and McLarens, and there's no way. It wasn't as good as those cars. And the team didn't believe it was as good as those cars, and the subsequent performance of the Sauber Alpha team suggests that there was nothing special about that car. There was a big aerodynamic shortfall of that car, which they still haven't fully recovered from, and it began with the new regs of 2017. And yet there he was doing what he was doing. He was, in terms of his peak stuff, the fastest stuff, I think he's astonishing. I think if we ever get to see him in a full season alongside Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton in equally competitive cars, I think we're going to have one of the most exciting seasons we've ever seen.
Interlagos Q2 in 2018 was a really memorable one as well in the Sauber. I remember when there was a bit of rain about and everyone else had pretty much accepted they couldn't improve, and he managed to get himself into Q3 with a mega lap. And the Singapore pole lap the year after as well. That's a proper live wire on the edge lap. Two or three really sort of big moments in between the walls with the rear being out. I'm probably a tiny bit less forgiving than you on the mistakes, because I think the measure of the great drivers is that they can live on that knife edge with a low strike rate of errors. Leclerc was a little bit high on that for me last year, but I do also accept broadly your point. So I'm more just sort of a little bit away from your position, but not quite as far as completely disagreeing, because yeah, you're right in that he's trying to reach in for those impossible performances when you're on that kind of knife edge peak of potential.
What I'm taking from that is that Ed thinks Mark's an idiot.
Oh, I think that still, but just on that point, I'm not completely at the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's a middle ground really to occupy between your positions there, because I think you are basically like one tiny iteration removed from from one another on where Charles' mistakes were. The thing that impresses me with his speed is that how he has learned to extract that when required in qualifying. Obviously, I feel like it wasn't really possible to judge that last year because of just how just maverick some of those laps were in Q3. That wasn't a case of, oh yeah, the Ferrari can definitely do that lap time, so Leclerc just needs to build up to it through Q1, Q2, Q3. He sort of, you look at how many times Sebastian Vettel failed to get through to Q3 in that Ferrari, and Leclerc was able to pull it out of the bag. But when the car was competitive in 2020, when it was good enough to be you knew that was a Q3 car, and then it was a case of, right, where can he get in the mix for that sort of Class B fight? But then if you look back to 2019 as well, and his first year at Ferrari after getting out of the midfield battle at Sauber, the thing that's really impressive with Leclerc is how he stopped being vulnerable to a Q2 elimination, or when the car's quick enough, not a Q2 elimination, but a lower Q3 result. Because at Sauber, what he found in his rookie season was he was obviously so on the limit the whole way through qualifying that there might be a small mistake here or there, but he found himself back absolutely on the limit every time he went out and did a lap in qualifying. He was always trying to optimize that specific moment. And sometimes that manifested itself in a brilliant qualifying result, and sometimes it manifested itself in Leclerc actually not doing better in the next segment than he had done in the segment he'd just qualified from. And when he went into 2019 with Ferrari, that was one of the big weaknesses, was he had one of the worst records in terms of his qualifying laps versus his theoretical best from a session. And through the first part of 2019, I think it was especially after, do you remember Canada 2019, Vettel did that pole lap, and I think Leclerc just wasn't on Seb's level that weekend. From then on, I think Charles realised that it was Q3 was the goal. and it was getting everything right for that lap in Q3. And it was a very subtle change, but it just meant that he's talked about this before, if there's a compromise to be had in Q1 because you're anticipating the track evolution through Q1, Q2 and Q3, he was willing to make that. He was willing to accept that compromise. It wasn't about, it's a little bit of the Max Verstappen in sort of 2017, 2018. It's not about being the quickest in every session. It's about doing what you need to do to get to the end point. And I think this has now manifested itself in just Leclerc being just such an ultra dependable qualifying asset. I don't have any doubt now about Leclerc going into a qualifying session and getting the most out of the car. And obviously in the first half of his first Ferrari season, that was obviously very much still there because he was still very inexperienced. I feel like now, not only is he prodigiously quick and capable of these crazy laps, he's rationalizing it, and he is putting everything into place to allow that lap to happen. So it almost seems like these laps come out of nowhere, and actually Leclerc is subtly putting the building blocks in place to make it possible.
Yeah, I think that the point you make about the really focusing on the significance of Q3, particularly when you're a driver expecting to battle at the front, that's absolutely critical. Sometimes people ask us why we put so much emphasis on qualifying pace, but the days where you can qualify 14th and have a good race set up and come through, they've gone. You can only do that in exceptional circumstances or outside of your control usually. So that is lap zero of the race, and it sets you up for the race that is to come, which is why it's so important and why this fundamental pace is so significant. If we just evolve in our discussion into racecraft, because this does touch on the question of errors. So racecraft, Scott, we're looking at as delivering that speed over race distances, consistency, tyre management. And there is this question of the mistakes, because the five big errors he made last year, there were three of them on the opening lap. So that was Styria, the collision with Vettel, clobbering Lance Stroll at Sochi, and harpooning Sergio Perez and Sakir. Obviously, Perez went on to win in that one, so in a way, he gave him a bit of a helping hand and put him on the right strategy in a very tangential way. And then, of course, there was the crash at Monza when he lost it at the Parabolica. And there was also the mistake he made at the last lap at Turkey, dropping from second to fourth. So we're talking here about not so much the mistakes made trying to deliver an on-the-edge qualifying lap, but particularly on a first lap of a race or trying to hold an advantageous position like Monza. He was up the order higher than he should have been because of the timing of the yellow flag, the caution period, because, of course, he caused the red flag. So, Scott, how do you balance all of those things up in the Leclerc equation?
Well, the first thing I would say is that when we're talking about a lot of these errors, we're talking about really, really small misjudgments that have big consequences. So it's not that he is this chaotic driver or a driver who lives on the edge and spills over it dramatically. I think it's obviously far less sort of denser spread of incidents, but I think it's a little bit like where Verstappen was at the start of 2018, but for different reasons. Verstappen in the start of 2018, I think he was just a bit careless, a bit rash. I think Leclerc is more sort of just tiny misjudgments, call it a little bit of inexperience, or if it's just sort of the specific nature of the situation. But it's really small mistakes that have big consequences. I don't think that Leclerc has a trait of making errors, and in fact I don't think I've and I might be wrong, there might have been one or two at the end of last year, but I've said this a lot, I'm adamant he doesn't make the same mistake twice. He's really good at learning from his errors. So if you look at a couple of the examples that you gave from last year, the one at Turkey is obviously one that really hurt him. He had that really emotional outburst after the race, and we'll obviously get to the mental side of his game in a bit. But that was because of the result that it cost. The actual mistake itself, which was just overtaking someone who was then faster than you in a straight line, trying to cover them off into the last overtaking spot of the Grand Prix on worn tyres where offline it was damp. Like, that's a completely understandable mistake to make. It is still a mistake, but I don't think it's a bad error. So I thought he was actually quite harsh on himself there, especially because everything that preceded that error, that cost him that podium was indicative of someone with tremendously good racecraft. His Turkish Grand Prix was magnificent. The way, especially once he sort of worked through the early stages and sort of got into a position where the tyre temperature was there and he had the confidence, he was absolutely brilliant in that race. So that's more indicative of Leclerc's racecraft. I think the mistakes are exactly as I've said before, just really small ones, like the start of the Japanese Grand Prix in 2019, where he collided with Max Verstappen. All that was carrying a slight, tiny misjudgment into turn one, and not quite expecting the front to wash out as much as it did, having a tiny bit of understeer between the two corners, and then clipping Verstappen, and obviously paying the price for it. But how many times have we seen an error like that? That's not indicative of a driver who's out of control. And that is the difference between when Leclerc occasionally makes these high profile errors or misjudgments versus, say, a sequence of mistakes like we saw from Verstappen at the start of 2018. Similar sort of outcome, similar in terms of it being small things that have big consequences, but different levels of whether it's outs because a driver's out of control and whether a driver is just making a tiny, tiny misjudgment that they will then learn from and not repeat in the future.
Yeah, I think it's just an extension of the same thing we were talking about in qualifying. I think, he's trying to do things and grab results that it's not the car's natural position. So, yeah, obviously, it's not always going to work. So if you take that Turkey incident on the last lap, yeah, he could have just sat behind Perez and finished third. Is that better? It's a better result, but is that better than trying to get second and just not quite managing it on a really, really marginal maneuver, because that's the only possible way that he might get second and finishing fourth? I would argue I'd rather see the driver try for the second place than just sit there and accept the third. I think that's a better racing driver in the round. On that day, it worked against him, but I think that attitude, when he gets the proper equipment, will serve him better than the type of attitude that would have just sat him there in third place. And I think that's what I mean by you've got to look at it in the round. It's not, you can't just isolate and say too many errors. You've got to say, what were the circumstances in which those errors were made? What were the competitive circumstances? And what was the thought process and the attitude behind them? And how will that all translate when you give them the car that you should have? And so, I don't look on those as, yes, they're misjudgments, but they're misjudgments that he forced himself. He put himself in a position where he had to make those judgments, whereas he could have just not have done that and just settled for something less. And I don't think that's I don't think that's a better racing driver. I think that's a worse racing driver that would make that decision.
That's true, but in the Turkey situation, the best racing driver is the one who pulls off the move for second.
But it may not have been possible to do it. It might literally have been an impossible manoeuvre to do. And it's so on the edge that you can't tell in advance. Sometimes you can. Sometimes it's obvious it's going to work. And sometimes it's obvious it's not. When it's obvious it's not, you don't do it. And when it's obvious you can, you do. But sometimes when it's marginal and there is a result there to be had, if you can pull it off, then the top driver should. The top driver should always go for it.
And I think the point that I was trying to make before about not making the same mistake twice, and I think that is an extension of racecraft, because it means that if Leclerc finds himself in a situation to get that situation again, who knows, maybe he goes into that final corner thing, if he's got ahead of Perez but Perez is coming back at him, maybe he just sticks on the racing line next time. I would back him to do that rather than and make Perez go offline onto the damp stuff. It's really easy to say in hindsight, I can't believe he went offline, that's really bad driving because it was damp there. But there was an element of grip even on the damp stuff because they were still on intermediate tyres. So I think we're hand picking a few very specific examples, quite rightly, because they are high profile examples. But very few of them, like for example the Austria clash with this in the Styrian Grand Prix with Vettel, like that's not that to me isn't. Leclerc, tiny misjudgment when he's trying to do something that, yeah, I agree he should be doing. I think he was wrong there, but he then immediately afterwards accepted full responsibility for it. He's able to look at those honest mistakes and accept them as honest mistakes. And I have been racking my brains while we've been talking about this, trying to think of symmetries between his errors. And the closest I can find is the Sakhir Grand Prix one versus Japan 2019. But there's even then, there is a very big difference between trying to run wheel to wheel or almost side by side, or you know, just on the inside of someone through a fast sweeping corner into a tight one, as it is at turn one and two at Japan at Suzuka, versus the situation in Bahrain where you've got two, three, four cars dicing, going into a heavy braking zone, and him thinking he would be able to get away with it on the inside and just making a misjudgment. That they're the only two incidents that I see as even remotely being a repeat mistake, but I'm not sure that's making the same mistake twice anyway.
Well, there's no two incidents are usually the same. There's always different, even ones that look much more similar than that. The only reason I think just have to be aware of these is that we're talking about a driver who could be the absolute number one in Formula One here. So the standard's obviously ridiculously sky high. So when it comes to, you know, a potential world champion driver, you're looking for a driver who can get everything right every time. And I don't have massive concerns on Leclerc on this, but I'd just like to see it all play out in a proper championship fight to make sure those errors don't happen. I suspect it'll be fine, because I do broadly agree that he's not some uncontrolled missile. But equally, it's important to address those questions and whether that's a fundamental problem. I don't think it is.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But just to, you know, picking up on something that that Mark was saying before, it's like that it's a different situation if you don't have that sort of car that's reliably running at the front. I'm pretty confident that Leclerc is now in a position with experience, with the mistakes that he has made and what he's learned from them, that if he got, let's say, if he was faced with the situation Verstappen was faced with last year, I think Leclerc is capable of that level of consistency, of that level of execution, of that level of not making a mistake, having a bit better judgment, having a bit better patience when necessary, and threading it all together. I just think the situation that we've seen him in over the last couple of years, one was in his first year driving for a top team and only a second in F1, and then the other, last year, is in a position where Ferrari is massively on the back foot and he's having to pull out heroics to get results. And I think that this is shaping him into a driver who, yes, has made errors, small or large, however you want to describe them. But I'm honestly so convinced that if he was given a better car, we wouldn't see him.
Well, we've talked in terms of racecraft. We've talked just about his errors. If you look at first race of the season where he finished second, that was a midfield car, and he's running for a large portion of the race in midfield, about where it should have been. And then you got opportunities under the safety car, and he had to basically had a very, very few laps left in which to get through that midfield pack. And he just did it clinically. He just got himself, just nailed the McLarens, nailed the Renaults, just straight up there, and was in second place. And it was absolutely way beyond where the car should have been, and that went perfectly. And there were several races last year where that car could not have finished any higher and shouldn't have finished as high as it did, Portugal being another one.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's so many races like that. Turkey was mentioned. That drive there was, prior to the last few corners, absolutely brilliant. I would argue that up until then it was probably better than Hamilton's drive to win, if you look at Leclerc's pace, because although Vettel was up there, he made up eight places on the first lap thanks to picking his way through. Leclerc didn't gain those places. He had to kind of pace his way to it. He was comfortably quicker than Vettel. And also, on speed and racecraft, Leclerc has basically destroyed Sebastian Vettel as a Ferrari driver. It's that level of performance that has led to a four-time world champion being dropped, even before last season's heroics. So I think that pretty much answers the question. Should we move on to the next category, which is technical ability, Mark? Fourth season, 23 years old, not the most experienced on the grid, but how strong is this aspect of his game?
It's building, and it was a weakness at first, as I think you'd be the first to admit. It was, the building blocks were in place, probably his first Ferrari season, but just needed to be refined, and it's a very difficult to really to call it on last year's performance because the shortfalls of the car. So I see no reason why it shouldn't be the finished article now. But let's see. I think when he initially came into F1, he was trying to set it up like a Formula 2 car, and it was just way too oversteer and taily to keep sustained pace and to keep the tyres in shape. It was very quick over a lap, but that was sort of engineered out of him, and he made genuine progress from there. And I think by the time he arrived at Ferrari beginning of 19, there were just, as Scott was talking about earlier, there were some refinements to be made on where you place the effort in terms of track evolution, because to go from a car where you pretty much have to be on the limit because you're not going to make it out of Q1 or Q2 every time you get in the car, to one where you don't need to do that. I think that took a little while for him to get his head around and to you know, intrinsically just automatically do it. But in terms of what he's asking from the car, I think the problem with last year's car, aside from the power shortfall, was it was on just lacked rear stability, and he was able to drive around that brilliantly. So trying to assess a driver's technical ability when he's driving around a fundamental problem with the car is difficult. That's why I sort of reserve judgment on that a little bit. I'd like to see how he engineers his car throughout a weekend in a car that doesn't have any fundamental flaws.
Yeah, I think that Leclerc sort of had to go for a little bit of a baptism of fire when he joined F1 to basically accept that he didn't know best. And that wasn't necessarily him being arrogant. I think it was just that enthusiasm combined with the fact that he'd been so successful in previous Formula that I think he was just quite determined to try stuff. And sometimes that wasn't just technical. I think it was at Bahrain in 2018. He basically was adamant that he should do a different strategy. And I think Marcus Ericsson came through from the back and grabbed a couple of points, and Leclerc had a miserable race because he hadn't quite got it. And I know when he joined Ferrari, I think he was very, very respectful of the depth of knowledge and the size of the operation. I think, you know, obviously Sauber was not a small team, but compared to Ferrari, it was. And when he was then properly immersed at Ferrari, I think he was like, okay, wow, there's a lot going on here, and it's going to take me quite a while to get my head around what works. And I think that's where he would have found an awful amount of benefit, just observing Seb and just sort of leaning on Seb a little bit. And I think we saw it manifest itself in his tyre management in the second half of 2019. There was an initial step there, but then in 2019, I think he felt that tyre management was a big, big step. And I know that sort of bridges the realms of racecraft and technical ability. But I think he's going through this process of learning all the time, and it's going to be really interesting to see how that manifests itself now that he's the out-and-out team leader, because he'd obviously positioned himself as the de facto team leader at Ferrari last year. That's why they wanted rid of Vettel. But there is a difference between being the guy that's trusted to lead the team on track and actually still and having all the relevant capabilities and qualities to drive the team off track as well. And someone like Sainz coming in, who has experience of different teams, he's you know, he's very, very invested in the off-track side of the job, and knows a little bit about the other power units, that kind of thing. It's just going to be really interesting to see how that balance plays out. I'd like to think that in his third year with Ferrari, Leclerc's going to have a lot to offer, and maybe he's going to start to sort of take the lead a little bit more. The car's going to be developed more around him. Obviously, 2022 is a completely different car entirely. So I think the next 12 months are going to be really interesting. I think this is probably the category in which there is most room for evolution, because this is probably the area in which he is still doing a reasonable amount of learning on the job.
And we can also say that technical ability, it's confirmed that it's evolving by the fact that Ferrari was willing to dispense with Vettel, because Vettel is good on that side of things. Okay, we know he's a little bit narrow in his operating window and what he's trying to achieve, but he's a hard worker. He works closely with the team. So they were quite happy to relinquish that even before Leclerc had turned a wheel in anger last season, which again speaks volumes. And I always, you want to see with drivers that methodical approach, that understanding that they need to be kind of across everything. We often talk about Lewis Hamilton in these terms of how important it is that he's not just quick and a good racer, but he does everything off track as well, leaves no stone unturned. And that's something he's really learned to do brilliantly over the years. So that's what we're kind of looking for Leclerc to refine. But I think like Mark, I do agree that we've yet to see that completely proven out just through circumstances of what Ferrari's offered him. You know, the driver doesn't design the car. Sometimes people say, oh, well, if he's such a good technical driver and development driver, then why was last year's Ferrari so rubbish? And it's like, well, it's not that simple. The driver has a minority stake in that whole thing. They can feed into what the team's doing, but if the team's producing something that's fundamentally limited, there's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, he's not there to design the engine and make it more powerful or give it more rear grip just by magic. Let's move on to the next category, which is kind of the final part of the three main pillars, if we want to look at it as speed, as the technical ability, and then you come to mental strength. So we do hear Leclerc berating himself over the radio after mistakes. Turkey was the most famous one last year. I'm sure a lot of people would have heard that video. Two schools of thought on that. Some think it shows a weakness that he's lost control, but others think it reflects the high standards he set himself. Personally, I'm in the latter camp. Where are you, Scott?
I think there's a third element of it, which is that it can be a strength. It's not necessarily just that it's indicative of high standards. I think it's a way for him to what's the word I'm looking for?
Well, I'd argue that is a strength as well.
It's a way for him to channel it. So I think that becomes a strength as long as it doesn't go too far. So we've seen this for quite a while now, right back to even before his F1 days. Leclerc was extremely hard on himself. You often hear drivers talk about themselves as their biggest critics. No driver, I don't think, admonishes themselves quite like Charles Leclerc. So I think when Leclerc says he's his own biggest critic, he's 100% telling the truth there, because I don't think anyone could possibly ever talk to Charles the way that he talks to himself over the radio. And I think that it's a little bit like when, you know, let's take another sport, for example, tennis, when a tennis player, you know, is screaming after missing a match point, or, you know, hitting it straight into the net, or failing to return a serve or whatever. I remember seeing this and hearing this, you know, a few years ago with Andy Murray, for example. There's always question marks over his temperament. You know, oh, he's just, all he does is, why does he shout and moan? It shows that he's not in control. Well, actually, that's not necessarily true. A driver, a sportsman, whatever they're doing, needs to have an outlet for the frustration that builds up, because they're only human. It shows how much they care. It shows what they consider to be an acceptable level of performance. I think the problem when it gets too far is when they get so worked up in the moment about it that they make mistakes. That's a problem of temperament. That's a problem of emotional control. An outburst after the fact isn't necessarily linked to them being out of control in the moment. So you can be angry about something, and that doesn't mean that that's the reason you've got something to be angry about, if that makes sense. So when Leclerc does it, I think he's just venting. I think he's so determined to get everything right. I think he's got such a good idea of what's good enough, and I think he's definitely one of those drivers, one of those people who doesn't believe that good enough is good enough. It always has to be at the highest level possible. So Turkey was because he was massively frustrated, because it wasn't just that he'd botched his move for second place, or thrown away, you know, turning third into second. He, you know, cost himself an outright podium and fallen to fourth. So he was massively, massively frustrated. What do you want the driver to do in that situation? Radio over to the team and say, "Now that's, oh well, doesn't matter. We'll try another time." You know, even the likes of Daniel Ricciardo, who's as laid back as a deck chair sometimes in high pressure situations, he's lost control. Was it Austin or Mexico in 2018? Austin. I think, didn't he like put his foot or fist through the driver's wall or his wall in his driver's room or something like that? So, it happens all the time. Look at Lewis Hamilton having that massive outburst in Russia when he felt that those penalties last year were against him and that they were unfair. You know, he could not let that go. You know, the race went away from him. He was really frustrated. It was just, it's a sign of passion. And it's a sign of, it is a sign of work ethic and high standards and all of this. So I'm not sure it's as simple as it just being a weakness or, oh, it just shows that he's got high standards. I think it's quite complicated. I think it can be a strength as long as he uses it to improve the next time.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's just desire. And, you know, apart from the ability to physically drive the car and a psychological makeup to control your passion, your ability, that desire is just absolutely as important as in determining the full package of the driver. And an emotion is, it can be a dangerous thing in the car. It can lead to mistakes, but if you have proper control of it, it can also be used as a driving force. And I think Charles is very passionate and does use emotion to drive them forward and to fuel some of his performances and the way he stretches out himself. And yeah, when he makes a mistake, it's just a frustration that it's coming out after the moment. And it, as I say, as Scott was saying, it's to do with taking that pain on board after you've released it and remembering it and funding it into your next time in the car. So, you know, I don't see it as a weakness at all.
I think if you look at a few very extreme examples, but if you look at the times in which Leclerc's had to handle tragedy in his life and how that has then, how he has then performed around that, I think that's an example of what level of mental strength he has. You know, as a young man to lose, first of all, his mentor and one, you know, a long-term friend in someone like Jules Bianchi. He lost his father as well. I think it was ahead of the Baku F2 race, wasn't
yes.
it? And then obviously with was it Antoine Hubert, I think, as well. So constantly around these things, these events take an enormous mental toll on people. You know, you can, losing one person that's close to you is hard enough. Losing more than that, you know, I don't want any driver to have to go through that test to prove their mental resilience. The fact that Leclerc's gone through it three times, and he's also won in incredibly high pressure situations as well, like his two wins, for example, coming under enormous pressure. And there's no greater pressure than leading the world champion driving for Ferrari in your first Italian Grand Prix as a Ferrari driver. There are fewer higher stakes moments in Grand Prix racing than that. So I think when it matters, Leclerc's got exactly the right temperament that you need from a Grand Prix driver.
I'd agree completely with that. I don't think there's any point you can indicate and say that's where he's lost control or emotions got the better of him. And the whole point, the reason why I see the high standards as such a strength is because while all the drivers on the grid have worked very hard to get there, they're very dedicated, they're operating at a very high level, there are drivers who give themselves an easy ride. Sometimes you hear them talk about it after the race. They'll say, well, that was about as good as we could have done. You think, well, actually, no, looking at that race, it's clearly obvious you could have been a couple of places higher if you'd done that right. And frustrates me when you see the drivers who seem to kind of give themselves that leeway. Sometimes it's just them being positive in public, but often it reflects a driver who, for whatever reason, can't quite to get to the very, very top level. You know, they're the kind of driver who will, in a season, have, you know, half a dozen really strong weekends, but then there'll be other ones where they're not doing that because they don't drive themselves on. And as long as it doesn't become damaging that you're sort of pushing yourself unrealistically hard, then that's always going to help drivers. You see this in all the very, very best. Final question mark on Leclerc. Hypothetical one, really, but it's taking everything we've discussed and putting it into a made-up situation, if you like. But we haven't seen Leclerc in a world championship fight in F1. I'm sure we will one day. But how confident can we be that he'd stand up in a fight against Lewis Hamilton or Max Verstappen? And how big a test of that is that to come for Leclerc?
It can only be conjecture, can't it, until we actually see it happen. But I've seen nothing to suggest that he wouldn't be up to that task. Nothing at all. I think he'd absolutely go toe-to-toe with either of those guys. And it would be fascinating to see.
Yeah, it's interesting when you try and extrapolate drivers out. Sometimes there's cases of drivers who you expect improvements in key areas. Bottas is an interesting example, because when he was at Williams, there were concerns about sometimes his feistiness on the cut and thrust of the first lap, occasionally about the tyre management. But at the time, I remember thinking that'll all come. But actually, once he was in Mercedes and up against Hamilton, he's very good in those areas, it hasn't quite come. But then I look at Leclerc and I don't see quite such big question marks. Yes, we've seen him at the front, obviously, with Williams. Bottas was never quite P1, although he was thereabouts in 2014 in particular. So, yeah, you don't see any little cracks to be opened. It would have to be some new weaknesses, I think, or weaknesses that haven't been tested at all that would have to then crack under what is the absolute ultimate pressure. How about you, Scott? This championship in your head, is Leclerc able to win it?
Yeah, he is. I've yet to see him face a situation he can't get on top of, whether that is through junior categories and obviously in his F1 career so far. I think he's proven from his very first season in Formula 1 that he's capable of very special things. And every year he smooths out the remaining and very, very small rough edges, becomes a more complete driver. Put it another way, his ability and his qualities as a driver is not what's going to stop him from winning a world championship in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and he'll get a chance eventually. I'm sure he will, just as Max Verstappen will. Wouldn't it be brilliant if all three of those, Hamilton, Verstappen and Leclerc, who I think you can make a very strong case of the three strongest drivers in F1 currently. Obviously, Daniel Ricciardo's kind of hanging on in there as a very, very high-level driver, and Fernando Alonso returning might have a little bit to say about that, but he's been on the F1 sidelines for the last couple of years. But that would just be such a great battle to see. But I think we've probably explained why we have been so impressed by Leclerc over recent years and why we had him third in our collective rankings. I think he was third in all our individual rankings when we worked them out for last year, and who knows what he can do this year. Shall we round off the podcast in the traditional way that we've recently revived, provided Scott has done some work on it? Scott's people, I think I did see some Twitter activity.
Yeah, I have done some work on it. The people have spoken. I've had more than 50 responses, totaling about 1,500 words. I've added every single one that I've had up until the point of recording to a little Google Doc. I won't be able to run through every single submission, otherwise we'll double the length of the podcast. But if people need reminding, the question I asked on the last podcast and then subsequently on Twitter was that if you could basically sit down and do the ghost writing for any racing personality's autobiography, who would it be and why? And we talked a bit about it, didn't we, on the last at the end of the last podcast. So Ed, you'll be delighted because I think you had a trio of supporters for Heinz Harald Frentzen. Ansi Rulamo, the Twitter user Air Laurens, and Marcio Goncalves. I'm very bad at pronouncing these names because it's really difficult with Twitter usernames to work out where the first name ends. I hope I've got that. Ansi said that Frentzen, so much fascinating stuff. The early hype, 97 disappointment, 99 title bid, the sacking, relationship with Schumacher, his personality. Air Laurens said it would focus on 1999. Marcio said he was so angry that Ed mentioned that his choice, that he smacked the steering wheel of the car. But Heinz Harald Frentzen would be great to get insight on how he views his talent and career, his view of Schumacher, Villeneuve, Eddie, Frank, Patrick, etc. So yeah, quite a few votes for Frentzen.
Can I just interject and say, if anyone wants a little bit more on Heinz Harald Frentzen, subscribe to Bring Back V10s, the current episode, season 3, episode 4, on the 99 French Grand Prix. Jordan Strikes Again, all about Heinz Harald Frentzen's win with Mike Gascoigne, who is, of course, technical director at Jordan. So there's some great insight into Frentzen there.
Very good. Well done. Good plug. Right. So I'll rattle through a few more and then I might actually have to run this question again next week because there was so many. Richard Randall said, Petro Denitz, ridiculed, out of his depth, pointless pay driver, and then out-qualified the reigning world champion at Spa. Pretty sure there's some good tales to be told there. Nikki Gray opted for Graham Hill. The stories about his achievements, contemporaries, escapades, and the dangers. Also because behind the cheeky grin, he seemed to be a thoughtful man. Simon M said there's probably an interesting study in mental resilience to be had with Luca Badoa, the mortal F1 driver. We actually had, what was really cool was seeing the fact that there was such a range of drivers from, obviously, from different eras. One of the interesting ones I saw was from Luca Ruocco, who said Didier Pironi. Here in Italy, he's still depicted as the villain by the vast majority of fans. It'd be incredibly fascinating to ask him about his point of view regarding Imola and all the hypotheticals had he not suffered injuries at Hockenheim. How easily could he have won the championship? Could he have beaten Piquet in 83? At Ikatosh23 picked Bob Fernley, mainly because apparently he saw him on the grid walk at the Australian Grand Prix in 2018 and says he will never forget that. From representing my new homeland of Sweden, Bram Kuhneman picked Ronnie Peterson. Said, imagine if he hadn't passed away and been as successful as people thought he'd be, maybe a multiple world champion. How would that have altered the view on motorsport in Sweden? Would we still have a Swedish or Scandinavian Grand Prix? And Matthias Hammer added, I would actually like to hear the story about Ronnie's wife, Barbara. How was it to have your loved one race in the 70s? Obviously, her death, what was the actual reason for it? An interesting and tragic life. And then we had, I will finish up this run through with a couple more driver suggestions because two people, Christian Rose and Niall Boyle, picked Eddie Irvine. Christian said he'd be great in the clash with Senna, Ferrari, the 1999 season. And Niall said, abrasive, driven and a terrific driver on his day. One of the last of the great F1 Mavericks for sure. And the last one that I'll include this week is from at Auto Tradition, who actually messaged me twice. Such was the determination that I wouldn't miss this. Picked Terry Fullerton, a British karting champion in 1973. Great insight on Senna and teaching karters today. Obviously, Fullerton probably gained most sort of recognition or prominence because of the Senna film, obviously being picked. I think that must have been the moment where Fullerton sort of became known to a slightly wider audience, at least, because he was picked as Senna picked him as sort of, that was the great rival, because Senna was sort of like reminiscing about the brilliance of the karting days and the simplicity and authenticity of the racing, right?
Yeah, he was a karting rival of Senna's. So yeah, that gave him a real boost. I imagine a lot of motorsport fans wouldn't have recognised the name, but it's relatively well known now as a result of that documentary.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what I'll have to do, because I don't think I even got through half of the responses that time, and I got some really, really nice answers. So I might roll that one over to next week if that's okay. I know that, Ed, you didn't have a proper answer last week. Frentzen was just sort of a bit of a, or maybe. But have you given it any extra thought, or, you know, might you, you never know, might you do your own autobiography? Are you that fascinated with yourself? Because obviously, as I think you saw, one of our Twitter followers, Jack, said that he'd ghostwrite Ed Straw's autobiography. So,
well, I did reply to his tweet and said something along the lines of good luck with making it interesting. But I think if I was to write my own autobiography, it would be great because normally books take quite a lot of effort. But that could be over. That's an eight nine pager, isn't it? So
it's a short story.
It's a short.
It's basically, your autobiography is basically a haiku.
Yeah, pretty much. So an easy task anyway. I think you'd have to get a lot of people's autobiographies written before mine was even getting onto the shortlist. So
also, you, as a writer, you shouldn't need a ghostwriter, should you? You should be able to do it yourself. That's your job.
That would be massive. It would be so lazy if it was like a 9-page autobiography and you're a journalist and you got someone else to do it for you.
Yeah, there's actually a real art in ghostwriting, isn't there? Because I'm sure we've all done it when sometimes when you might get a first-person column written by a driver or some personality. Sometimes we'll end up ghostwriting them, and it's it's quite a challenge sometimes, and often it's quite a challenge based on who you're doing it with, because some of them are much more professional than others, should we say, in terms of trying to be interesting. But the ghostwriter's art is not a high profile one by its very, very nature. But good for you, Scott, for popularizing the idea. So
well thank you for everybody who submitted a suggestion. So feel free to continue to do so. Send me a tweet. I'm at SMitchellF1 on Twitter, or just use the hashtag Scott's People. Occasionally I do search for it, and it does amuse me greatly when I see that there are actually tweets on there.
Excellent. Well done for looking after your people for the second time in 2 weeks. That's an impressive strike rate for the off season. Thanks very much, Scott and Mark, for your insights. Hopefully we've been able to give people a little bit of an idea of why we rate Charles Leclerc so highly. Do head to therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen, as I always say. Plenty to read on there. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do so. And of course, Bring Back V10s, which I mentioned earlier. Season 3 of that is in full swing. And also check out our YouTube channel. Just search for The Race. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of The Race F1 Podcast.